Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will indeed be finding common ground and taking it to the max level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. When you keep an open mind, you'll come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. You'll also see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now, tonight it's my pleasure to welcome Drs. Ron and Mary Halnick. They are pioneers and worldwide leaders in the field of spiritual psychology, as well as teachers and facilitators of awakening and consciousness. They are renowned educators, authors, and the founding faculty and co-directors of the University of Santa Monica, where they have designed, developed, and facilitated educational programs for the past 35 years. Both are licensed marriage and family therapists, and Mary is also a licensed clinical psychologist. They are authors of Loyalty to Your Soul, The Heart of Spiritual Psychology, published by Hay House, which is available in 12 countries and 8 languages. Their latest book, Remembering the Light Within, A Course in Soul-Centered Living, was published this year by Hay House. And so let me welcome the doctors. How are you doing tonight?
Well, we're doing great. How bad could it be? We're here with you.
There you go. Well, that's quite a compliment. I appreciate that. Well, as I mentioned to you earlier, I really love the title of your book. It is just it just epitomizes what it's all about, that we all carry that light within ourselves, and it's up to us to make it shine. What was the inspiration for writing your book?
Well, really, we have been teaching the principles and practices of spiritual psychology for almost 40 years. And so this book really is an expression of some of the foundational aspects of spiritual psychology. But actually, the inspiration for this book occurred when we decided to create an online offering called 33 Days of Awakening for a segment of our community. And it was well received. In fact, shortly after that, we had a conversation with Arianna Huffington, whom we've known for many years. She was still with the Huffington Post at that time, and as well as her sister Agape, who is a USM grad. And we were just catching each other up on things that we were doing. And when Arianna heard about 33 Days of Awakening, she said, I would love to offer that to a segment of our Huffington Post readership. And so we did. We had over 20,000 people register for that course in 128 different countries.
It was wild.
It really was exciting. And then after that completed, I was thinking about the book and talking with Ron, and we decided to write to Reed Tracy, the CEO of Hay House, about the material and suggest that we write a book. He loved the idea, and thus here we have Remembering the Light Within, A Course in Soul-Centered Living.
Well, what is soul-centered living?
Soul-centered living basically starts with the awareness, as it was said at the beginning of this show, a better description of us than human beings with a soul is that we're souls And rather than having a human experience, we say using a human experience. And what we're using it for is the purpose of awakening. So we come here, we're alive, but basically we have what Mary refers to in the book as spiritual amnesia. And we don't really remember the other side, the soul side that we come from. And so once you learn about that perspective and you learn some of the skills and the practices, the principles and practices of what we call spiritual psychology, as you practice those, you start to live what we call a soul-centered life. So you're more concerned with awakening than you are necessarily with success in the material world. Not that we don't deal with success in the material world. It just ceases to be the major function. And that's why, it's remembering in two ways, not only because we forgot, but we're renewing our membership. Remember. We're remembering ourselves to the body of spiritual beings. And so it has that connotation. So that's what this book is all about. It really, if it's used as a course, then each chapter has principles and practices, and we suggest that people work with these practices over a 2-week period and see how they work for them. And it's done in 26 chapters so that it neatly fits into a year-long course should people choose to use it that way.
And what I would say, just the short answer, soul-centered living is really awakening into the awareness of who you truly are as a spiritual being, and then living life from that awakened state. Our essential nature is love, is peace, joy, creativity, wisdom. And when we learn that we're something more than our personality and ego, and that this is already present within us, it's like, I think life changes.
We've seen lives change, thousands of them, through the use of these principles and practices. And it's really what you were saying at the beginning, where we start to see things in a different way, and we have realizations that come from a higher level of consciousness. For example, I think we're all aware that there's just a lot of, let's call it turmoil, that's present on the planet at this time. And a lot of people are polarizing themselves to take this side or that side. And whichever side they take, they are very much against the other side. And it doesn't seem to dawn on very many people that if you are against anything, the act of being against is really promoting the thing that you say that you're against. Because you're adding to the sum total of the negativity, the againstness that's on the planet. So our perspective is, let's find ways to embrace, let's find ways to cooperate, let's find ways at the very, very, very least to let go of the individual againstness that we have within ourselves. That's what this work is really all about.
Well, let me ask you a question. You said that these principles were ones that we had forgotten. Why would we have forgotten them?
Well, you know, that's such an interesting question, and I think part of the answer depends on how esoteric a person wants to become. Our experience of working with more than 5,600 graduates of the university over the past 35 years, we have had so many experiences where people awaken into their essential nature. And when they are in that consciousness, they are the presence of love. They speak from a place of clarity, of inner knowing, of wisdom. And my own point of view about this, David, is that just being born into a physical body ensures that we are going to forget. We are more than our body. We have a body, but we're not our body. We have a mind, but we're more than our mind. We have emotions, but we're more than our emotions. We're really a center of pure, loving awareness. And one of the principles of spiritual psychology is that Earth is a school, and that each one of us come with our own unique curriculum. And that curriculum consists of the issues that we came to heal, the gifts that we came to share, and the opportunities within us to really live into those deeper, more heartfelt aspirations and dreams that also are inherent in each human being.
In addition to what Mary is saying, if you want to learn algebra, for example, the assumption is that you don't already know algebra. Otherwise, there'd be no point in going to learn it. In a spiritual analogy, there's no point to leave heaven to go to heaven because there's no learning to be had. You already know everything that that school has to offer. And so when we come into this reality, when we're born here, it involves that we have to have a certain amount of forgetting. Otherwise, we can't participate in the school itself. And this is one of the reasons why many of the sages and mystics over time choose to live rather simple lives, because they start to withdraw from all of, let's call it the, well, I don't want to call it the craziness of everyday life here, but all of what is easy to get involved in here and get caught up in the whole school. It's like one of our principles is the goal is not to change the school, the goal is to graduate. So very many people these days especially are very much caught up in trying to change the school. And that doesn't really, that's not going to take them where they want to go, because that's not what it's about.
Well, thank you for clarifying that. I would like to back up just a little bit and talk more about spiritual psychology, because I haven't heard that term before, and you've talked just a little bit about it, but I wondered if you would share some more on what spiritual psychology is all about.
Well, to start with, if you look up the word psychology in the dictionary, you're going to find something like the study of mind and behavior, things of that nature. And that's what psychology has become. It's come into what we might refer to as the medical model, where there are diagnoses or things that are maladies in people, and the goal is to let's say heal them. But if you look up the word psyche in the dictionary, what you're going to find is breath of life, soul, things of that nature. So psychology has veered away from that. I've heard it said it's been hijacked into a medical model. But what it really should be about is the study of the soul and what the soul is doing here and how the soul learns. So by calling it spiritual psychology, it's our goal to bring it back to the essence from which it was brought forward in the first place. My first teacher used to say that the reason that psychology was inspired on the planet to begin with is because humanity had forgotten why it had come here. And I think that's really very accurate.
That makes sense.
And we refer to spiritual psychology as the art and practice of conscious awakening, of remembering who you are as a spiritual being, and that your life has purpose and meaning and opportunities not only to awaken, but to be of service as well.
Thank you. Well, can you tell me why the book is so important for this place and time that we're living in?
It appears as though, and again, I have to kind of wax a little esoteric here to bring a full sense to it, but humanity is at a very, 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 let's say at a very, very important crossroads. We have just completed a 25,000-year cycle. It's like, think of it as a spiral. Well, the first circle of the spiral is complete. So we're back to the beginning, but at a higher level. In the Eastern traditions, that period of time is recognized and is called a yuga, Y-U-G-A. And that period is divided into 2,000-year cycles. And each cycle has a different lesson that we're learning. And each cycle has a distinct teacher who was the way shower of that particular 2,000-year period, that they demonstrated the lesson that humanity was going to be working with over the next 2,000 years. So if you go back, let's say between 2,000 and 4,000 years ago, the world teacher was Moses. And the teaching was, because prior to that time, there were all these gods. There was a god of this and a god of that. And Moses' main teaching was, no, everybody, let's get clear. There's really only one God. So it was a shift into that kind of an orientation, and it was that God that brought down the Ten Commandments. Whether that happened in physical world reality or not is immaterial. It's the idea of it. And then we come into the next 2,000-year period, and the teacher of this past 2,000-year period that we're coming out of was the Christ, and the lesson was, hey, everybody, not only is there one God, but that God is to be found within every single person. Same one. There's no difference. And so we've been working on that one for the last 2,000 years, and now we come into, we're just 17 years into it, what's been called the New Age or the Aquarian Age. I'm not aware yet of anyone or anything that I would say would be a world teacher, but I do have a very good idea of what the lesson is, and I would say that the lesson is cooperation. So not only is there one God within, but what does life starts to look like when I, let's say, come into relationship with somebody else who also knows that? What kind of relationship do we have? What kind of marriage do we have? What kind of businesses will we have? Do we really even need countries anymore? So we see people starting in to talk about those sorts of things, but it can only happen to the degree that we learn how to cooperate to a much higher level than what we have been on this planet up until this time. So as we see it, that's what the next 2,000 years are all about. So you could look at this Remembering the Light book, as well as the Loyalty to Your Soul book, as well as the programs we offer at the University of Santa Monica. These are kind of, you could look at them as courses in how to come into a greater level of cooperation, first and foremost with yourself, and then with everybody else in your life to the extent possible. That would be the long, short answer.
Okay, well, thank you for that. I was just wondering, and excuse me if you've already answered this, I was looking at some of the questions that your publicist provided to me, but how do you see us coming to this place of cooperation? Do you have any foresight as far as that goes?
Yes. One of the cornerstones of spiritual psychology has to do with accepting personal responsibility, personal responsibility for the disturbances that you experience inside yourself. Most of us are addicted to a chronic "I'm upset because" response to certain situations, people in our lives. And spiritual psychology really is a process of authentic empowerment where we say events do not cause your feelings. They trigger material within your own consciousness. So rather than trying to change what's going on outside yourself, you focus instead directly on the disturbance inside. Another principle of spiritual psychology is healing is the application of loving to the places inside that hurt. And so by learning how to relate with ourselves in a more self-honoring, compassionate, and accepting kind of way, we can actually heal the hurts, we can heal the disappointments, the causes that bind us into the restriction and limitation that we may have as a way of life. Spiritual psychology is incredibly liberating.
See, on the planet at this time, there's a huge, the mode, the way that most people respond is that the dynamic goes something like, that happened out there in the world, and that upset my peace. And so we look outside, and then we try to change the thing that happened outside that we believe is what is at the root of our disturbance.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact of the matter is that that's not really the way it works. The way it really works is that something happens outside, and all that has really happened is whatever has happened. It doesn't do anything. What disturbs your peace is the rule you have about the way it should or shouldn't have happened that way. And if it's something that you have a rule that says that's a good thing, then that same thing will result in you having a sense of happiness. If it's something that you have a rule inside that says that's a bad thing, then you will get disturbed and you will be possibly angry. So these feelings, when viewed from the perspective of spiritual psychology, are really nothing more than feedback mechanisms that our own soul is using to show us where we are off course. So we say, the first order of business is the willingness to take responsibility for your own disturbance and quit blaming it outside, which is a great definition of a victim. That's what a victim does. Mm. And so what we have found out over the past 35 years of doing this work is that when people start to be willing to take that level of responsibility, lo and behold, they can actually go inside and discover the place inside that is disturbed, discover what the thought pattern is that is the one that they are believing in, and then let go of it. When they let go of it, and truly let go of it, what they find happening is that same thing will happen outside. It just no longer disturbs their peace. And in fact, they become much more effective if they so choose to work for that. If you want a really great example of that, was a woman named Julia Butterfly Hill out here in California a bunch of years ago. some logging company was going to cut down about 30 acres of these beautiful, amazing sequoia trees. And she said, you know what, I got to do something. That's not right. Well, what she did was she climbed up in the 200 feet up into one of these trees and refused to come down. Mm-hmm. And so the logging company said, well, okay, how long can she stay up there? And, of course, the press was all over this. Well, she stayed up there, I think it was 2 years, either 2 years or 4 years.
Oh, my.
one month seems like a long time to me. But she was up there at least 2 years, and the press was really just giving them all a hard time. And so the logging companies finally just capitulated, and they said, hey, you know what, come on down. We'll create a park, and we'll keep these trees, safe, and we won't be cutting them down. And they did that, and they honored that, and she came down. Well, of course, when she came down, the press was all there, all the stations, and they're putting microphones in front of her mouth, and they're saying, where did you get the courage to go against the logging companies? She said, what are you talking about? I didn't climb the trees because I have anything against the logging companies. I climbed the trees because I love the trees. And so she did an action that proved to be very, very, very effective, but it came out of a place of love, not out of a place of upset and disturbance. And to us, that is the big lesson on the planet today, so that more people can learn how to have that kind of an attitude as they go forward. And that's an attitude of cooperation.
I love that story. That's wonderful. And the things you're saying make absolute sense to me. It's just the state of being human is such a challenge in terms of dealing with these thoughts and emotions that trigger reactions that hopefully we can come to use in a positive way so that we're not reacting. What I was wondering is, I just lost my train of thought, so let me try something else instead. tell me a little bit more about the exercises in the book. Does it matter if they're practiced in order or not?
Well, the book is written in a way that is sequential, that builds. However, somebody could open up the chapter on compassionate self-forgiveness. They could find themselves in a state of judgment, of emotional upset. They could read that chapter and work with the activity, and I think they would have a very valuable experience independent of whether they had read anything else in the book. So while there is a sequence and progression to the chapters, I think each one stands in its own right.
It does, and just like when you go into a course in school, it's hard to be, let's say if it was a math course, it's hard to do advanced examples when you haven't yet mastered the fundamental or the foundational examples. It can be done, but it's written in a sequence that really one thing builds upon the other. And we have found over time, this is the way we teach it in these highly experiential programs that we do. And it's, if you just start with an easy thing that someone can do and they go, well, that wasn't so hard, we say, great, now let's go on to the next thing. And we just keep building from there.
Beautiful. Well, you talk about goal lines and soul lines in the books. How do we move beyond the goal line?
Well, the goal line, of course, is the life we lead in physical world reality. And, the fact is we are here in these bodies. We have to eat. We have to earn a living and all of that kind of stuff. So we have to deal with that. When we start to move into the realization that while this is going on, there's a whole other reality going on at the same time, which we refer to as the spiritual reality, we start to ask questions that are very mind-based, ego-based questions, such as, well, all right, you know, 10 steps to this. And then, of course, because we're geared toward a goal line orientation, someone else comes along and says, I can do it in 7, and then everybody runs that way. And then I saw a cartoon in the my New Yorker calendar the other day. Here's Moses coming down the mountain with the commandments, and the throng, someone is, you know, they're waiting for him and they're cheering, and someone says, are those the 10 best commandments, you know, the 10 top commandments? And I'm thinking, that's, you know, that's very much ego thinking. But
uh-huh.
when you start to move into the more esoteric realms, where you start to move into soul line thinking, you start thinking about different things. You start thinking about things like, am I seeing the beauty of the flower that is sitting right there in front of me? Am I recognizing that? Or am I so busy on my cell phone that I'm passing these things by as I go? We start saying, well, gee, how am I relating to this other person? When I speak to somebody, am I more concerned with making my point in the conversation, or am I more concerned with listening to their perspective? I already know everything I'm going to say. I might learn something by listening to somebody else. And therefore, some of the very early skills are things like heart-centered listening and perception checking, and the most basic one of all, seeing the loving essence. So if you want something for your listeners that will change their lives, very easy thing to do. It's the very first thing we teach people. Take a day, say tomorrow. As soon as you wake up in the morning, everyone you see, hold the awareness that they are a spiritual divine being who is engaged in a human experience. No matter what they're saying, no matter what they're doing, no matter how silly they may seem or how anything, it just doesn't matter. And that's the first step. So you start entering into the awareness that there's this other reality going on. And then it's something that one awakens into over time. You know, and that's why the book is called Remembering. You don't remember, very few people remember all at once, although there have been cases in history where people did that. They just, all of a sudden, you know, the bolt of lightning came down and they woke up. But the vast majority of us don't do it that way. We do it one day at a time and one step at a time.
Right. There's been some talk about the ego, and I think from a spiritual standpoint, quite often it's not a good thing. But are there any positive aspects of the ego, or ways that we can engage the ego in a manner that is not going to enter us into conflict with other people?
Yes. You know, the more people awaken and the more they resolve some of the unresolved issues within their consciousness, their ego or personality actually can become quite pleasant, harmonious, and functional. We need an ego in order to operate in physical world reality, in order to move forward, in order to do or accomplish things. So the ego is not the enemy. However, it is very helpful to become aware and to be able to distinguish between ego reference thinking and authentic self reference thinking. Ego reference thinking tends to be critical, it tends to be judgmental, it tends to be operating inside the duality of good, bad, right, wrong. Where ego reference thinking, I think, is well. Authentic self reference thinking is best represented perhaps by a quote from Rumi. He said, out beyond ideas of right doing and wrong doing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. And to us, that is the field of unconditional loving, the field of creativity, of joy, of peace, of wisdom, of play, and of transcendental happiness. And we all have the opportunity to awaken into that field, into that level of consciousness. And many times people have had moments of it. They've had tastes of it. They may have had an experience in nature or when their child was born and they held their baby for the first time, perhaps when they were married to their partner. This can happen in all kinds of ways. But the ego is not the enemy. We are not proponents of killing the ego. We are proponents of learning how to work your process so that rather than being so reactive and disturbed by other people and situations, you can take a look at, well, what is my belief system? What are the rules or shoulds that I'm holding in my consciousness, not only about how I should be, how other people should be, how the world should be, how life should be, and so forth, because all those rules and shoulds become very restrictive, limiting beliefs that then tend to, when things aren't the way we think they should be, then we feel bad, we feel unworthy, we feel unhappy, we feel dissatisfied. But we can cleanse the lens of our perception by learning processes, and we have some of these in the book that help people really consciously explore and examine their beliefs and really evaluate, are these the beliefs, are these really serving me? Can I let these go? And are there other beliefs that would work better for me in terms of my everyday life? We all receive an incredible amount of conditioning, and so the conscious examination of our beliefs and learning how to release them can be extremely liberating.
One of the ways that you can think about this, we do this with a PowerPoint presentation where we have this gigantic ego that's toward the top of the page, and then this little tiny authentic self down at the bottom of the page, and it's even known because very often it's referred to as the still small voice within that every now and then we hear. But as you do this work, what begins to happen is that the ego voice tends to reduce its size and its power, while the authentic self voice tends to get stronger and you hear it louder. And you eventually get to a place where the authentic self is running your life and the ego has taken its rightful position as the loyal servant. And so you use your ego in order to get things done here. The ego has been called the personality, the self. I love a quote. It's a quote attributed to an Eastern philosopher who went by the name of Wee Woo Wee, which I always thought was a great name. And he said, 99.9% of what you think and everything that you do is for yourself. And there isn't one.
Oh, I love that.
I love that idea. And so you start to come into that reality that, and things take on a whole, your life takes on a whole different perspective, and you don't do things for the same reasons you did them previously. You do them for other reasons, things like being of service to other people, things of that nature.
Well, it sounds like it takes a tremendous amount of commitment and work to lead a soul-centered life. I mean, we live in this duality of good and bad, darkness and light, and there are benefits to living in darkness because that's part of the lesson that we have to learn to overcome and live in the light.
And judgment is just such a common aspect of human experience, and we do have all these shoulds. And I love what you were saying, Mary, about the process of releasing them. It's easier said than done. are there any key points that you want to make about releasing judgment, so that we can lead more of a soul-centered life?
Yes. You know, I think there are several things I'd like to share about this. Some of the most foundational soul-centered skills that we teach as part of our work are seeing the loving essence and heart-centered listening. So we, right from the beginning, are introducing people to the awareness. There's something greater within you. Your nature is loving. And we're going to invite you to look with the eyes of your heart and to listen with the eyes of your ear. Excuse me. To listen with the ears of your heart. And so right away, we bring people, we start bringing them inside the spiritual context, which is unconditional loving. And the students in the classroom begin, they learn how to relate with each other in ways that are kind, that are supportive, that are authentic and genuine, and very, very honoring. And as we go on, we help people become more aware of their beliefs. We help them begin to understand and see for themselves the connection between their beliefs, their thoughts, their feelings, and the judgments that they're making. And then we introduce them to compassionate self-forgiveness. And we don't forgive ourselves because we've done something wrong. We forgive ourselves for having judged. For judging ourselves, for judging someone else, for judging a particular aspect of our lives, because it's judgment that creates the terrible feeling of separation inside, where we feel bad, we feel awful, we feel unworthy. And compassionate self-forgiveness, it dissolves the judgment. It can dissolve a limiting belief, and it's a healing balm to the place inside where we experience emotional pain. It is a profoundly transformational tool.
This is really the linchpin of the whole thing. And this is what's so hard, because so many people were brought up to believe in the right-wrong model. That's the ego's model. Entire religions are built on that premise. But from the perspective of spiritual psychology and from the perspective of the authentic self, there is no right and wrong. There is no good or bad. There just is what is. So something happens. Now, what do you want to do about that? Can you do whatever you want to do with the place of love? If you make what happens wrong, and this is so hard, because it seems so obvious that there is so much that is wrong or evil or bad in the world, it's very easy to move into that judgment. So once we recognize that, then what we are actually forgiving is, I forgive myself forever buying into the notion that that thing out there in and of itself is wrong or bad. I let go of that judgment. That is very, very, very hard. As you said earlier, this is not a walk for sissies. But this does free people. We've seen it. We've seen it thousands of times. In fact, sometimes it's so profound. You know, it is not at all uncommon for somebody to be working in the classroom. And, you know, as I said before, these classes are highly experiential, and they'll have an experience, and they'll share in front of the group, and they'll say, I had no idea. I had no idea this was available, that I could move into this kind of a place. I read about it, but I realized I didn't know what that meant. And this is another thing about why we do USM the way that we do it. Most of the educational system in this world is built upon what I would call a didactic presentation. So we read books about something, or we hear lectures about something. But if you think about it, that's not knowing the thing. That's only knowing about the thing. If you want to know the thing, you have to experience it. So, for example, one of the things that I did when I was younger is I got a private pilot's license. Well, I could read 1,000 books on how to fly an airplane and what's involved. But until you get in the plane and you have the controls in your hand and you're making the plane do what you want it to do, you don't really know about flying. I mean, you don't know flying. And so in our classrooms, people are continually working on these processes, and they'll go on for an hour at a time, sometimes even more. And they're all designed so that when we present a principle, that people can have the experience of what that principle is talking about. And that to us is the way that people convert knowing about into knowing. It's very powerful.
It sounds it. It really does. We have several callers on the line. Are you open to taking a couple of calls?
Sure.
Okay, and before we do that, what's the best way for people to get in touch with you?
Yes, go to our website, theuniversityofsantamonica.edu. It gives information about our programs. And in terms of the book, people can go to ronandmaryholnick.com and get more information about awakening the light within, or excuse me, remembering the light within.
Okay. Either way sounds
so
beautiful.
Yeah.
But let's get the title right.
And it just so happens.
There are some rights and wrongs as far as navigating in this world goes.
The accurate title is Remembering the Light Within.
Right.
And
how do people best obtain the book?
I think going to Amazon or Barnes & Noble online, either of those two big booksellers make it very easy for people to get it.
Beautiful. Okay. Well, I know the identity of the first caller. I haven't talked to any of the callers tonight, but I recognize this phone number. And this is Deanna, who follows the show pretty closely. Deanna, you're live on the air. Would you like to say anything to Drs. Holnick?
Yes. Hello, David. Hello, Ron, and hello, Mary.
Hi.
And before I go to my question, I guess you could also get your book at Hay House, which is where I heard your last interview.
Yes.
So, I'm big on words, and I believe I've always misunderstood this one word, judgment, because I thought, well, we're entitled to our opinion, so we have to be able to judge. I feel, and please tell me if this is right, I feel that the way we're using it nowadays is more like a rejection or repudiation or condemnation rather than judging right and wrong and things like that. Do you agree?
Well, in the English language, the word judgment really has two meanings. Originally, what the word was all about was evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
So that meaning still is retained in areas such as, let's say you're having a wine tasting contest or something like that. And the people who are doing the tasting, they are judges of good wine.
Mm-hmm.
So said that way, they are just simply making evaluations, which is to look for the value in something. So if one is using judgment in that sense, it's fine. But what the word has come to mean largely when we're entering into judgment there's an element that comes in of wrong-making. It would be like saying, these wines are the bad wines, and we should go out and burn the vineyards and kill the winemakers, and nobody would do that. But yet that's what we do when we enter into judgment, and we see, when we enter into judgment, we pretend to know what's right and what's wrong. And really, from a spiritual perspective, there's only one being that I'm aware of that can make that distinction, and that being isn't on the earth. It's in some other dimension. But you get the sense of what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's more than a criticism. It's the problem.
It's a condemnation. You're sentencing someone. You're rejecting them.
Yes.
It's a repudiation. And because it is such a trendy word nowadays, I think a lot of people are misunderstanding it. So
yes.
I wanted to get your opinion of the word.
See, it when used that way, when we make anything wrong, we are pretending to know God's will. That's what we're really doing. And personally, I don't want that responsibility. I don't want to pretend that I know that. So I make evaluations. I look for the value, and I run experiments, and I try something out, but I don't make people wrong. The benefit of that is that I don't have very much upset going on in my life, because it's the wrong-making that takes you into upset. And there's a lot of evidence that upset is very closely related to impaired health. The medical profession is finding that more and more.
And what I would add is that judgment tends to cloud the lens of our perception. And so as a result, we tend to see in ways that include distortion. And very often then our perspective becomes biased, it becomes restricted, and it becomes unclear. You probably had the experience of talking with someone who is very out of balance and in a lot of judgment about something. And you probably were very aware at the time that because of the judgment and upset they were experiencing, they really weren't seeing clearly.
I agree. I just don't think that judgment is equivalent to hatred.
No, it's not. There is a distinction between them. Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you, Ron. And thank you, David.
Thank you, Deanna. I appreciate it. Well, it seems that our other callers are shy. They've disappeared from the switchboard. I think they knew that I might be coming for them, but that's okay, too. I do have a question, and this has to do with God's will, and I appreciate what you were saying about that. Is it possible to pray for knowledge of God's will, or is that not a possibility?
I think it's definitely something that we can pray to know God's will. And I would say from my own experience that God is love, and that each one of us is awakening into the awareness of our essential nature, which is love as well. And so when we reside in the loving inside ourselves, in that place of loving without restriction and conditions, that we are much more likely to be in the place where we are in a more elevated consciousness and we can have a sense of what is truly for the highest good of all concerned.
Thank you for that. Follow-up question to that would be, what do you believe are the most effective forms of prayer?
Heartfelt prayer. Heartfelt prayer. I think, Meister Eckhart said a wonderful thing. He said, if the only prayer you ever say is thank you, that will be enough.
Mm.
And I love that quote. I think it's brilliant, inspired, and very accurate that the attitude of gratitude and prayers of gratitude, rather than prayers to what we perceive as a giant bellhop in the sky, who, you know, like praying for the new car, the new house, the partner, all these things that we want, that we think will fulfill us, really is a misunderstanding of the beauty and power of prayer.
One of the things that we do in the classroom is we have this thing called ideal scenes, where people they write out in different forms what they'd like their life to be like. But at the top of every one of these sheets of paper, in big letters, it says this or something better for the highest good of all concerned. So it's like, Lord, this is my best shot at my understanding. You've got a better plan. I want to go with yours. But this is the best as I understand it.
And I think what Ron just shared is one of the big keys in prayer, to pray for others for their highest good rather than for a particular outcome. And there is research that has been done that shows that prayers without conditions have actually been statistically shown to be more effective than prayers that had conditions or strings on them.
I couldn't agree more with everything that you said. In fact, Mary, what you were saying about the prayer of thank you resonates with something that one of my guests said once. I had an urban minister on, and I've forgotten her name, but I asked her what she said, what she thought the most important prayer was, and she said simply thank you.
Yeah.
So.
Yes, and we definitely echo that, and that is our practice, prayers of gratitude. To me, gratitude opens the doorway to grace.
Yeah.
And it puts us in proper relationship with the divine.
Well, I couldn't agree more with that either, and we just have a couple minutes remaining. Is there anything else that you would like to share about your book and the time that's left?
In addition to the book, it just so happens that once a year we do a weekend Loyalty to Your Soul workshop, and that weekend is coming up tomorrow, in fact. So,
oh, wow.
If there are any listeners that want to hop on a plane and come on out to Los Angeles tomorrow, we would love to have them.
Well,
you know,
you never know.
No, yes. You never know.
And I think my closing comment really is that waking up is so worth it. It is. It just changes everything. And rather than life being one of pain and disturbance and suffering and hardship, it really can become a life of love, of joy. It doesn't mean it's going to be without trial or tribulation, but it brings one into a consciousness of greater awareness and altitude. And so as a result, rather than things that happen being perceived as punishment, we can recognize them as learning devices and ultimately as blessings.
In fact, from the spiritual perspective, the only thing that is really going on here is awakening. And the only real variable is how long we're going to take, how many lifetimes we're going to take. And the nice thing about spirit is that since it doesn't exist in time, it really has all of infinity to work with us. Although we may not like that. So we say,
right.
Let's get with the program.
I agree. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show tonight. It's been a joy.
You bet.
Thank you, David. A pleasure to be with you.
Well, God bless you both. And right now, let's take the time to pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are having a human experience who can and will have a spiritual experience when we let it be. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize. Good night, and God bless.